I'm Bob Custer, host of Reader's Corner. Today I'm speaking with Arianna Newman, author of When Time Stopped, a memoir of my father's war and what remains. I'm Bob Custer. Welcome to Reader's Corner. Arianna Newman grew up in Venezuela with a father who never talked about or explained his past in Nazi Germany and Czechoslovakia. Newman embarks on a journey of personal discovery about what happened to the Newman family under the Nazis. When Time Stopped, a memoir of my father's war and what remains, is what Arianna Newman discovered after years of traveling the globe, learning that past her father could never talk about. There are a few interviews I've done at Reader's Corner when the story is so compelling that I ask the author if our conversation can fill a second half hour. Arianna agreed, so the interview you will be listening to shortly is the first half of an hour-long interview. We will run the second interview next week. Arianna Newman worked as a foreign correspondent for Venezuela's The Daily Journal, and her writing also appeared in The European. She currently lives in London with her family, and she joins us today from London for this interview. Arianna Newman, welcome to Reader's Corner.
Thank you very much for asking me to join you, Bob. It's a great pleasure to be here today with you.
You know, I was thinking as I was reading your bio and your years in Venezuela, I stumbled across a YouTube of you and your father. You were a little girl and you appeared to be at the beach or something. And just for our listeners' interest, in addition to reading a great book, it was so much fun seeing your father in person, so to speak, and to see you and the two of you relating to one another as father and daughter. That was really cool. So I recommend that to our listeners. But let's kick this off, if we could, Arianna, with the basics. How many members of the Newman family were living in Czechoslovakia in 1939? How many escaped the transports that took them to the camps? And finally, how many escaped the transports which took them to the camps? And then how many altogether survived?
So I have to start by telling you, Bob, that when I was growing up and until very recently, I didn't know how many members of my family there were. And I really just knew my father and his brother. So as far as I was concerned, there were two. And I now know that there were actually 34 of them living in what was then Czechoslovakia. And 29 of them were sent to transports. The ones that weren't sent in transports either were saved by mixed marriages or hid from transports or were young children from mixed marriages. And out of those 29, only 4 came back.
Now, when you say transports, help us understand this. These are transports to camps that were tiered. And maybe you could explain the tier system in Nazi ideology that caused this all to come about.
So it was, I mean, the Nazis loved classifications and rules and laws. And the more Jewish you were, so if you, it was literally measured by how many Jewish, it wasn't a choice, it wasn't a religious choice, so to speak, but it was a racial choice. And it was determined by how many grandparents, how many Jewish grandparents you had. And again, Jewishness was a matter of origin. It wasn't a matter of faith. So the more Jewish you were, the more quickly you were deported. They also had, I mean, they had classifications for people that were non-Jewish. So they believed that the German Aryan race was the purest. And Czechs, for example, were slightly inferior, but not as bad as the Poles or the Russians. But of course, if you were a Russian Jew, then you were absolutely the bottom of the bottom. And what they did is they started serving something called transport notices, which would arrive to Jewish people's homes. And this was after, obviously, years of dehumanization and years of little laws which stripped Jews of all their possessions and their right to work, for example, and the right to, you know, own typewriters and things that were really arbitrary, or to go to restaurants or to go to barbers or to go shopping. So after they dehumanized them, they then would send them this transport notice, which would effectively say, please show up at the train station and you're going to be transported to a different place, a better place for Jews where you would live. And most Jews, certainly initially, had no idea where they were being sent. And there were, of course, sent to concentration camps. Some of them went to ghettos, and Theresienstadt is often called a ghetto. Theresienstadt was the camp just on the outskirts of Prague, where most of my family ended up going, or at least arriving before they were transported to other camps. And Theresienstadt was a relatively nice camp, if you can say that about any camp, in the sense that it was a work camp. It wasn't an extermination camp, for example, like Auschwitz or Bergen-Belsen. It was a camp which was used for Nazi propaganda, so there were no gas chambers in it. And it was billed as a retirement village for Jews, really. But of course, that was completely false, and it was a front. It really was an absolutely horrific place, which was designed for 5,000 people, and at its height, I think, had 80,000 people. So while people didn't die by being gassed, they died of disease and starvation, and just, you know, because they were subjected right to these horrific conditions.
Thousands of them, I think you say in your book.
Yes, I don't have the numbers in front of me, but there's tens of thousands of people that died in Theresienstadt. And then, of course, many of them were also then transported east, because if the illness or the hunger didn't kill you, then you would be transported further east to other camps. And if you were fit enough and young enough and healthy enough to work, then you would survive as long as you remained those things, as long as you remained useful to the Nazis. But if you were infirm or perceived as weak or elderly, then you were just gassed right away, because there was no point in wasting precious food and feeding you if you were not going to work for the Nazis and their camps.
Right. And of course, your father and his brother were, of course, survivors because they were of value to the Nazis. And we'll get to that in a moment. But before we get there, I'd like you to elaborate on a brief comment you made about the fact that you really didn't know anything other than two members of this family, your father and his brother, your uncle, Lodar. You learned about this, of course, in a very interesting way that is really the story of the story. Could you tell us about your father, living with your father over the years, how much you knew then, who he was in Venezuela, what you did not know he was before then, and then how you decided, or when you decided, to come up with the idea of this book?
Of course. So I grew up as far away as you can imagine from the Holocaust and from World War II and from Europe and from all this darkness. I grew up in, you know, the tropics in sunlit Venezuela, in the Venezuela of the 70s and 80s, which was then very different, of course, than the Venezuela now. It was filled with potential and promise. And my father happened to be one of the most successful men there. He was an industrialist, but he was really a sort of Renaissance man. So he was involved in education and in reforming government policy, in bringing over qualified immigrants from Central Europe. He was involved in museums. I mean, you name it, he was involved in pretty much everything. And as his daughter, it seemed completely normal to me, because he was always so busy and so engaged in his present life, and so excited by the promise of the future. I mean, he would always be reading sort of Omni magazine, and, you know, he died in 2001, but as early as sort of 2000, he was making internet calls to me, which weren't great quality, I have to tell you. So he was really excited by the, you know, he was so involved in the present, so excited by the future. It seemed completely normal to me as his child that, you know, there was never any talk about the past. So all I knew as I was growing up as a little girl, and I was pretty much, my father had an older, had a son who was 23 years older than me, but I grew up as an only child. All I knew was that he had emigrated from the Czech Republic Czechoslovakia in 1949, that he had emigrated with his brother. And all I was told really was that, you know, he had emigrated because he was escaping communism. He was escaping a broken Europe. So I never questioned, I never really questioned that. And Venezuela, it was then filled with immigrants of all sorts. And again, I think they all chose to forget their past. So I was pretty oblivious, really, I was completely oblivious to this history. But my father, with all this, you know, he was very powerful and he was very active. There were little moments of darkness and weakness that sort of seeped through into our technicolor existence, really. There were moments that just jarred with our life. So my father, for example, would wake up in the middle of the night when I was a little girl. And I'm not talking about once or twice. I'm just talking about dozens of times that I remember, where he would scream at the top of his lungs and he'd wake up the whole house in the middle of the night. We'd all hear these horrendous screams. And they were in a language that I now know to be Czech or German that I didn't understand. And that made no sense, of course, because my father, you know, he was busy with work stuff, but he didn't really, I didn't think, have any reason to have these nightmares. And anytime that you asked, so as little kids do, you know, I had a huge Venezuelan family on my mother's side, and there were loads of pictures of them and of my mother and all my cousins. But my father's side, there was only one picture of my grandparents. It was a really sad black and white photograph. It was pretty small. It was by his bedside. And if I ever asked about my grandparents, my father would immediately change the subject. He would go as far as telling me that they were called Otto and Ella. But that was it. And if I asked anything else, his hands would start to shake. So I think that was another clue that there was a mystery to my father, something that he just could not or would not share with me. And then when I was 9 or 10 years old, as you do when you grow up in a beautiful garden in Venezuela on your own, you form a detective club with your friends. So I was inspired. I read lots of Enid Blyton and Nancy Drew and this a geek detective called Encyclopedia Brown. And I wanted to be just like them. So I formed a detective club and we started spying on people. And in one of those afternoons where we all gathered and spied on people, someone spied on my father. He had been moving a box. And when I went to find that box, to find what it was that was inside that box, I found an ID card. So I was about 8 or 9 years old and I opened this box and inside was an ID card with a photograph of my father. I had no doubt that it was him. He had me rather late in life when he was 50. And the man in this picture was probably in his 20s, but he looked exactly like my father, just less wrinkled, darker hair. I could recognize his eyes. But in the part where it said name, my father's name was Hans Neumann. And this ID card said Jan Sebesta. So that made no sense. And it was an ID card from Berlin, which again made no sense because my father, I knew, was from Prague. So I think that's really when I realized that there was a mystery to my father. And when I asked questions about this, I ran to my mother and I said, you know, we're living with this man who is not who he says he is. He's an imposter. My mother said, you know, he had a really difficult war. He can't really talk about it. He just had to, you know, pretend to be someone else for a little bit. But don't ask him any questions because he gets very, very upset. So I think that's when it all started for me. And it really wasn't until much later on. My father died in 2001. And that was the moment, really, after he died, that I felt I had permission to finally solve the mystery of my father. And the reason I felt I had permission was because every time I had asked before, my father would get so visibly upset or would say, I don't want to talk about this, you know, that I very quickly learned that that was just a no-go area. But my father was a collector of things, a collector of papers. And when I went after he died to clear out his house of what I assume would be hundreds and hundreds of letters and papers and things, it had all been tidied away. And he had left me this box, the same box that I had found as a child detective, with that same ID card with a different name. But this time it was just crammed with papers from his war, not in Prague, but in Berlin. And that sort of set me off on a mission. I became that little girl detective again. And I didn't do it immediately because I was having kids and I was living in London and I didn't know what I was going to find. And I didn't want to delve into this darkness just as I, you know, had to go upstairs at night and read fairy tales to my children. I just didn't think I could do both. But eventually, in about 2008 or 10, I started asking questions and I started piecing things together. And I started by hiring an archivist in Prague who helped me piece all of this together. Because, of course, I grew up speaking Spanish, but I was never taught German, certainly, or Czech. So I got a little bit of help. And in about 2008, 2010, I started on this journey, which has taken me pretty much all over the world. I've traced family in and friends, actually, in Israel, in Indonesia, in California, in Paris, in the Czech Republic, of course. And it's just been the most astounding journey. And it wasn't actually really at all ever meant to be a book, but it was really just a personal journey of discovery. And it became a book in about 2017, so not that long ago, simply because I started unearthing these, you know, these beautiful stories of people that were related to me, but irrelevantly of whether they were my family or not. There were these remarkable stories about them, and I felt that if I didn't tell them, then I would lose them and I would lose their stories. But also there were incredible tales of courage and bravery and love, you know, of all these other people around my family, most of whom weren't Jewish, and most of whom were just enormously brave and did the right thing and helped them survive. So I really felt it was my duty to tell the story. And then I was incredibly lucky that I told the story to someone who said, "Oh, wow, this has to be a book." And I said, yeah, you know, my husband always says it should be a movie. And then it just, you know, it started the ball rolling. And very quickly thereafter, I got a deal with Scribner, and now it's a book. So and it sold incredibly well. And I apparently more than 5 people have read it. So I'm sure.
And just to remind our listeners, you're listening to Arianna Newman, and she is the author of When Time Stopped, a memoir of my father's war and what remains. I'd like to drill down on something you just said about the amazing heroism you found among your father's friends and relatives. There's so many examples in your book of heroism often displayed by people who really did not have to place themselves in the grave danger they did. In some cases, I guess it was out of love. In other cases, it was out of friendship. In all cases, I think it was about revolting against this despicable Nazi regime. But I wonder if you could just share with us the story of your uncle Lodor's wife, Zdenka. I'm sorry if I didn't pronounce that correctly, who seemed to risk her own life often in pursuit of helping other people, including your grandparents.
Oh, Zdenka is my hero. I mean, she really is. And she is actually the hero of the book. You very kindly say that my family was brave, but my family didn't really have an option. They either chose to do what the Nazis told them to do, or they tried to escape. So it wasn't really bravery. It was just trying to save their own skin. But the people around them chose, as you say, to put themselves in danger. And Zdenka was one of them. So Zdenka was in love with my uncle Lothar. They had met, and they had been studying French together in a school one summer in the south of France. And Zdenka was a little bit older than my uncle. So, and she's this incredible, I call her a character because she's sort of larger than life. But of course, she's a real person. And she was a law student. She drove her own car in the 20s. She was incredibly independent. And she was incredibly bold and really passionate, and also had the luck of being independently wealthy because her grandfather had built some buildings around Prague and had left them to her. So she had, you know, she had people paying rent to her, which meant that she had a little bit of access to money, which proved crucial because my father's family owned a paint factory. But of course, as the Nazis marched into Prague, they were stripped of all their possessions and their ability to work eventually. And most of the family lost their jobs, they lost their houses. So really, Zdenka, in 1939, she starts acting as a courier to the family, taking them food, taking them money when they needed it, and driving around, which of course was completely illegal. And then she marries Lothar, right? So she's a Gentile. She is stunningly beautiful, in addition to being incredibly clever. And she could have, you know, she could have married anyone she wanted. And she decided to go in the middle of the Nazi empire and marry a Jew. So, you know, I think that's pretty, I don't know what the expression is, but you have to be very, very brave to do that, especially when your family is telling you not to do that. But you could say maybe, you know, maybe you're it's driven by love. In any case, it was brilliant that she did that, because she then became the source of joy and the source of everything that is good in my family. So as my grandparents were sent to concentration camps, they were sent actually to Theresienstadt in 1942, Zdenka sneaks into the concentration camp, into the camp of Theresienstadt, which is a really insane thing to do. It's a really difficult thing to do. There are some documented cases, but it's still very, very rare. And, you know, she just basically found a way to do it. She talked to contacts in the resistance. And in the summer of 1942, she sews a yellow star on her coat, and she goes in with the field workers from the camp that were picking vegetables, and she sneaks in with them into the camp and goes and finds my grandmother. And actually, I have traced Zdenka's daughter, who told me the story, and Zdenka also left some writings about this. And then the other thing I'm incredibly lucky to have is when I started asking questions and I started, you know, knocking on people's doors, all these other boxes of documents arrived, including a box of documents with letters from my grandparents in the camp. And they were letters that were snuck out of the camp because Zdenka organized a system of contraband so that my grandparents could have a little bit of extra food, a little bit of extra whatever it is they needed, matches or another sweater. And out of these, you know, these couriers that brought the weekly supplies into the camp brought out these remarkable letters. So I have, you know, my grandmother in the letters saying, oh, you know, I was despairing, I was depressed, I thought there was no meaning to life. And then I saw Zdenka standing on my doorway, and I all of a sudden, you know, had hope again. So Zdenka does these incredible things, and she sneaks into the camp not once, but twice. In 1944, again, my grandparents are still in Theresienstadt, and they, the resistance knew, and my grandfather knew, that it was key to appear younger than your years, because if you appeared weak, then the Nazis would send you off to the gas chambers. So, and I'm not sure that my family knew that they were going to be sent off to the gas chambers, but they knew that whatever happened was not good. So you had to appear strong. And my grandfather had a head full of white hair. He was in his early 50s, but his hair was completely white. So one of the things that the family and Zdenka snuck into them was hair dye. And when the hair dye became hard to find in the war, it was shoe polish. And in 1944, there was a moment where the couriers became unreliable. They were scared of the consequences. So Zdenka sneaks into the camp again to take my grandfather some hair dye, or some shoe polish, actually. So she is just incredible. You know, she's incredible. And I think I actually owe my father's life, and certainly my uncle's life, to her.
You have a ring sitting on your desk with her initials. Could you explain that?
I do. It's, it's the most prized possession I have. And when I first found it in a box, I thought, what a strange trinket to leave behind. Why would anyone keep this? Because, you know, it's not a precious jewel. It's not gold. As a matter of fact, I've now found out, and it's made of a plumbing pipe, like a copper pipe that you would use in plumbing. So it's just a copper ring. It doesn't look particularly anything. But then I eventually found the story behind it. And you see, when my grandfather was in 1944 in Theresienstadt, and he had absolutely nothing at all. He had no belongings. He had whatever he had was provided basically by Zdenka and by her parcels. He wanted to say thank you to her. So he went and stole a piece of copper pipe. And this is particularly remarkable because my grandfather was a very sort of petty engineer. So it's not like he was an artist or a jeweler, but he stole a piece of copper pipe, and with a nail and a hammer, in whatever free time he had, of course, because they were all worked all the time, he fashioned this ring, and he fashioned it with his hands. And it has a Z for Zdenka and an N for Neumann. And And it's a ring that he ensured got out of the camp and found its way to Stenka. And you'd have to read the book to find out why I have it and not Stenka's daughter. But I'm so grateful that I do have it, because it's a connection to my grandparents. And it's something that I know that my grandfather touched. Not only did he touch it, but he made it. And I can, 70 years on, even though I never met him, I can hold it in my hands and just, feel like I'm connected to him.
Sure. And the book is When Time Stopped, A Memoir of My Father's War and What Remains. And you're listening to the author, Arianna Newman. You traveled with your father to Prague in 1990, Arianna, and you relate a part of that trip when he asked the driver to stop at what must have been an old train station. And you have a quote that I'm going to just read this little brief partial sentence, and then I'll let you comment on what happened there. There are sorrows that cannot be conveyed, wounds with which you learn to live, but never completely heal. That may, in fact, be the story of your father's life. But I wonder if you could tell us about that moment when you stopped with your father at this place.
Of course, Bob. So, it's one of the most incredible memories I have of my father. And it's possibly the most poignant and the most, I think it's the one where I really genuinely felt the depth of his pain and felt, just that I really genuinely couldn't help him. And it was, we had spent 3 days wandering around Prague, and he had pretty much outright refused to talk about his family or to take me anywhere where his family had been until that very last day. He actually took me to this apartment building where his family had lived. And as we were heading back, and I don't know if you've been to Prague, but the center of it is beautiful. I mean, stunning. Every building is more pretty than the other. The squares are stunning. The churches are incredible. And we were sort of in the outskirts, so there was nothing pretty about the area that we were in. It looked like a, industrial sort of suburb, really. And it was pretty ugly. And my father all of a sudden became quite agitated in this taxi and started speaking in Czech, which he hadn't really done at all whilst we were there. He insisted in speaking English to everybody because he said I wouldn't understand. But he spoke in Czech to the driver, asked him to stop. And all I could hear him really say was "bubni, bubni," and I didn't know what that was. And we stopped at an old train station. As far as I could tell, it was disused. It was, the tracks were overgrown with grass. And I just said, "Why are we here?" And my father just walked, as almost as if he had been in a trance, towards the station, towards the tracks. And there was a fence between us and the tracks, and as I was just saying, what is this? He just kept on saying, this is where we said goodbye. This is where we said goodbye. And all I remember is looking at that fence, the fence in front of us, and it started to sway, and it was swaying with the force of his sobs. And I just tried to calm him down. I tried to, I asked him who said goodbye, and he just could not speak. And he was so visibly upset. It was just horrific. And it was almost like he wasn't there. And I did my best to calm him down and to tell him that, that I loved him. But I think that was the moment that I realized that there are just some things that even love cannot heal.
Can we assume that that was the site where he would have said goodbye to his parents for the very last time?
Absolutely correct. Yeah. That was the site where he where his mother had been deported from, and where he was separated. He was wrenched from his father. Yeah. He was saved at the very last minute from being transported in November 1942. And that was the place where he had last seen his father alive.
Arianna Newman, thank you so much for joining us today at Reader's Corner. Next week, we will continue our conversation about the book When Time Stopped, A Memoir of My Father's War and What Remains. Reader's Corner is presented by Boise State Public Radio News. The engineer for today's show is Eric Jones, with production by Joel Wayne. I'm Bob Kustra. Please join me next week as we talk to today's leading writers about the ideas and issues that help shape our world at Reader's Corner.